This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 28, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Fighting continues in Kufa and Najaf today, despite an announcement by U.S. occupation authorities yesterday that a ceasefire agreement had been reached. In Washington, D.C., six Central American governments are set to sign a broad free trade agreement with the U.S. called CAFTA. And Walmart is battling to enter two black communities in Chicago. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Bush administration-controlled Iraqi Governing Council has named their candidate for prime minister, Iyad Alawi. Beginning in 1991, with an order signed by the first President Bush, Alawi and his organization, the Iraqi National Accord, was promoted as the answer to Saddam Hussein by the Saudi government and funded by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. Alawi, a former Iraqi intelligence chief, attempted a military coup in 1996, also funded by the CIA, but failed. Today at the United Nations, reporters were unable to get a straight answer from the UN spokesperson about how much influence Lakhdar Brahimi had in the decision, a decision he was supposed to be responsible for and which President Bush said this very week Brahimi would make. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
At a tumultuous news conference today, reporters grilled UN spokesperson Fred Eckhart on the Iraqi Governing Council's choice of one of its own as the most powerful member of the government set to take power on June 30th. They asked what had happened to the UN's repeated promises that the caretaker government Lakhdar Brahimi is helping to form would be representative and acceptable to a wide cross-section of Iraqis. Eckhart said Alawi had been high on Brahimi's list, but refused to say whether Alawi was Brahimi's choice.
The Governing Council named this person today, and Mr. Brahimi respects that decision and will work with this person to now name the other members of the interim government, I assume.
Reporters said, however, that the Security Council was waiting to hear from Brahimi and was expecting a list of names, not a candidate. There was no word yet from Brahimi himself. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
The U.S. prison system made its largest increase in 4 years, according to the latest assessment from the U.S. Department of Justice. Nearly 2.1 million people are in federal, state, and local jails, with federal prisons making the largest jump and now holding the most people. Federal prisons are also 33% above capacity. Among the states, prison populations in small states had the highest growth rates, yet the largest state prison populations are in Texas, California, and Florida, respectively. 12% of all black men in their 20s are behind bars, while 1.6% of all white men and close to 4% of Hispanics are in jail. Defense counsel has rested after calling only one witness in the case of a University of Iowa student accused of supporting terrorism. Lee Robartis has more.
Lead defense attorney David Nevin abruptly streamlined his defense of Saudi University of Idaho student Sami al-Hussein after federal judge Edward Lodge disallowed testimony about the defendant's actions after 9/11. Al-Hussein is charged under the Patriot Act with aiding terrorist recruitment by maintaining a number of Islamic websites. The single defense witness was 27-year CIA veteran Frank Anderson, who testified he had learned about terrorist recruitment methods while recruiting terrorists as spies in the Middle East. Anderson, who said he served as station chief in three unnamed Middle Eastern countries, maintained recruiting involves developing a close personal bond and is unlikely to take place through websites because, quote, people are not inclined to kill women and children. Closing arguments begin Tuesday. Lee Robartis, Free Speech Radio News.
Latin American and European leaders are meeting in Guadalajara for a rapid-fire trade meeting that is close to passing a public resolution on the treatment of POWs, yet more deals are being made behind closed doors. Vladimir Flores has more from Mexico City.
The summit's purpose is to open multilateral agreements between Latin American and Caribbean markets with the European Union. Protesters say that these types of summits only turn Latin America into a battleground in a rivalry of economic dominance between the EU and the US. Absent from the meeting were the leaders of Peru, Argentina, Italy, Great Britain, and Cuba. Bolivian President Carlos Mesa announced the signing of an agreement with Mexican President Vicente Fox to export natural gas to Mexico. In October of 2003, a similar proposal for the exportation of gas led to a popular uprising in Bolivia. In Mexico City, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Fighting continued in the southern Iraqi towns of Kufa and Najaf today, despite an announcement by U.S. occupation authorities yesterday that a ceasefire agreement had been reached with rebel leader Muqtada al-Sadr. On the southwest edge of Baghdad this morning, around 3,000 Iraqis held Friday prayers at Abu Ghraib prison. Salam Talib and Dave Enders have this report from outside Abu Ghraib.
U.S. helicopters took to the air to intimidate demonstrators after they began throwing rocks because troops standing guard told them to pray across the highway from the prison rather than directly in front of it. Fahad al-Samarai came from Samarra, around an hour north of Baghdad, as he does often.
I have 18 relatives in prison. I come here almost every day. Since 6 months, I have no information about many of them.
Though occupation officials have called attention to prisoner releases in recent weeks, the U.S. military still says it is holding more than 7,000 Iraqis for security purposes. Many are classified as high security detainees who are not allowed visits from family. In past months, however, the visit process has become more organized. Abd Armaya Salah, from Ramadi, an hour west of Baghdad, visited his brother after a month of waiting. About 30 visits are granted daily.
We were only allowed 30 minutes. We waited inside for 1 hour while they brought them into the visiting tents. We were separated by two pieces of glass. There were more than 20 people in the tent for the visits, and we all had to shout to be heard through the glass. The visit was worth nothing, but at least I was able to see him.
Today, despite the announcement of a tentative peace agreement between Muqtada al-Sadr and U.S. forces, it was reported that militiamen loyal to Sadr attacked a U.S. convoy guarding busloads of prisoners in Kufa. There were also clashes in nearby Najaf, but Iraqis are still hoping the tentative peace agreement will hold. Many asked why both sides have waited until now. Ali Kadim, a salesman in the heavily Shiite district of Kadmia.
It would have been better if he had done this sooner. Why did so many people have to die?
In Kufa today, Sadr did not deliver his regular Friday sermon, but in Baghdad, Shiites loyal to Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who Sadr has snubbed in recent weeks, held a celebratory Friday service. All those present called on moderate Shiite leaders to join Sadr's fight if this peace does not hold. Mohammed Haidari led the prayers.
We told Muqtada and the coalition forces in the beginning to pull out the troops. Muqtada offered a peace agreement to the Americans before, but they refused. If they do not accept it this time, all of us will fight against them.
Also today in Baghdad, members of the interim governing council nominated one of their own, Ayad Alawi, to become prime minister on June 30th when the U.S. is expected to hand over some modicum of power to an Iraqi government. Ahmed Fawzi, the spokesman for United Nations envoy Lakhdar Brahimi, who is charged with choosing the next prime minister, declined to say whether Brahimi supported the nomination. In Baghdad, this is David Enders with Salam Talib reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
In Washington, D.C., six Central American governments are set to sign a broad free trade agreement with the U.S. called CAFTA. However, the Bush administration acknowledged yesterday that once this agreement is signed, it will not be submitted for a congressional vote before the November elections. Anastasia Gunazuditskaya and Selena Masuda report on the continuing pressure by various communities to stop this trade agreement from being institutionalized in the U.S. and Central America.
More expensive! Central American trade ministers from Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and the Dominican Republic gathered in Washington, D.C. with U.S. Trade Minister Robert Zoellick to sign the Central American Free Trade Act, CAFTA. Outside the Organization of American States headquarters, where the agreement was signed, protesters against CAFTA say that the act of opening markets under the agreement will not lead to prosperity for many. Some, like Stephanie Weinberg, a policy advisor at Oxfam America, say that CAFTA will resemble failures of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which liberalized the borders of Mexico and Canada.
After 10 years of NAFTA, the destruction that it's caused for farmers in Mexico, 15 million farmers have been forced off their land. The price of corn has dropped 70%. And farmers can no longer survive in Mexico, small-scale farmers. The same is going to happen in Central America, where nearly a third of the population depends on agriculture for their livelihood.
Many of the countries that will sign the agreement have also been accused of union busting and other labor violations by the AFL-CIO. The AFL-CIO, a union representing 13 million workers, opposes CAFTA because they say it does not address adequately workers' rights. Thea Lee, chief internationalist economist of the AFL-CIO.
We, the AFL-CIO, have asked for workers' rights protections in trade agreements, and yet what the Bush administration has put forward is very, very weak. They're only asking that countries enforce their own domestic labor laws, and even the enforcement provisions that they proposed are likely to be pretty ineffective.
Many proponents of NAFTA say that critics of the agreement are unrealistic because they seem to be against all forms of trade. Costa Rican former Minister of Planning and Economic Policy Otis Solis says that critics, including the 17 parliament members of Costa Rica, who are against CAFTA, are not against trade but against unequal trade.
The richer European countries, whenever they have extended the European Union to poorer countries, truly these poorer countries have been forced to open up their economies to everything. But Europe is one single labor market. So Irishmen and women, Spaniards, Greek, Portuguese, and now from the 10 new members, they move freely throughout Europe. So it is true they are forced to open up their economies to everything, to the richer, more competitive economies, but also they have a labor market, a one single labor market. Here you know how many visas, working visas, are given to Central America? Zero. Their globalization and free markets are no good.
CAFTA will be sent to the legislative bodies of the 6 Central American countries to vote. For Free Speech Radio News with Selina Masuta, I am Anastasia Gnizditska of the DC Radio Co-op.
On the heels of announcing a repeal of the terrorism legislation that many have likened to the Patriot Act, today India's new government unveiled what it calls a common minimum program. While many in India, irrespective of party allegiances, seem happy with new Indian Prime Minister Dr. Manmohan Singh, many wonder if he can turn things around for the poor of India, who voted the pro-Hindu right-wing BJP party out of power. Dr. Singh and his team say they have plans to ensure that the India Shining campaign by the BJP party reaches all Indians, but many are doubtful. FSRN correspondent Binu Alex reports.
One is an economist and the Prime Minister of India. The other is a follower and the finance minister. Together, Dr. Manmohan Singh and P. Chidambaram make what the economists call unbeatable combination. They claim that India is looking towards the next century as an economic power. Keeping this in view, a common minimum program of the United Progressive Alliance, led by the Congress Party, was released yesterday in consensus with the coalition partners. Dr. Singh described his budgetary priority.
To ensure that the economy grows at least 7 to 8% in a sustained manner over a decade and in a manner that generates employment so that each family is assured of a safe and viable livelihood.
India-Pakistan relations is a key area for economic prosperity. The better the relations, the less the expenses on arms and ammunition. The new government has vowed to find a peaceful solution to the 14-year insurgency in Kashmir, where around 40,000 people have already been killed. Navjot Swarna is the Indian External Affairs spokesperson.
The External Affairs Minister recalled that in his conversation with the Pakistan President, Prime Minister Dr. Manmohan Singh had also conveyed support for the process and emphasized the need for it to continue in an atmosphere free from the menace of terrorism and violence.
The outcome of the election is also seen as a resentment building among the 500 million or more Indians whose hard lives in rural areas and miserable conditions in poor urban areas worsened, while the urban middle class witnessed a high-tech boom and rising foreign investment. The new government has said it has to create new jobs. But how? P. Chidambaram is the new finance minister.
At the moment, I think jobs are being created in the service sector, but jobs are declining in the organized manufacturing sector and in agriculture.
For this, he has already prepared a list of Fortune 500 companies and will invite them to India to invest in a cheap but technically superior environment to base their production program. In an agrarian economy like India, no government can afford to ignore the country's millions of unemployed skilled laborers and agriculture workers. Meanwhile, research firms like Forrester Research is forecasting that 3.4 million U.S. services jobs will move offshore by 2015, mainly to India. The 71-year-old Prime Minister has held top economic policy-making jobs, including that of Reserve Bank Governor, and has worked for the International Monetary Fund. He is responsible for opening the Indian economy to the outside world and dismantling the socialist-era system of business permits and import restrictions known as the License Raj. The Oxbridge-trained economist Singh is a Sikh who could be the first member of a religious minority to hold the top job in the nation of more than 1 billion people. The newly chalked out program also includes repealing India's Anti-Terrorist Act, POTA, which the previous Hindu Nationalist Party is alleged to have misused against Muslims. Another promise the new government is offering is the reservation of 33% of seats in parliament for women. Communist Party leader Brinda Karat says the role of women in the country will have to be defined. But Hindu nationalist leaders, including some members of Vajpayee's party, have criticized the agenda, calling it too left-oriented. For example, the disinvestment policies of the previous regime are done away with. Profitable state-owned companies are no longer for sale, and the government is said to be eager to cut back on massive state subsidies to politically connected farmers and businesses, and to invest the money instead in badly needed roads, airports, power plants, healthcare, and education. The Prime Minister, through his appointment of Finance Minister P. Chidambaram, is likely to push India even further to open its markets to foreign products and investments, particularly those that would help India realize its potential, not just as an exporter of high-tech services, but as a low-cost producer of textiles, computers, and generic drugs. By doing this, India will directly target the China's production superiority. From Ahmedabad in India, Pinu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
And you're listening to Free Speech Radio News. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. A deeply divided Chicago City Council passed one Walmart zoning request for Chicago's West Side and delayed a vote on a second request for the South Side in a contentious battle to build two Walmarts in the city's African American communities. The proposed new stores are at the cutting edge of a company campaign to aggressively expand into urban areas across the country. The Chicago zoning fight has shaped up as the most significant battle for the company since Walmart lost its bid to build a superstore earlier this year in Englewood, California. Chris Giovannis reports from Chicago.
Walmart's lobbyists have adopted techniques more commonly seen in grassroots campaigns or electoral fights, including the veneer of populist promises for jobs and growth. Company representatives have attended neighborhood meetings, hired door-to-door canvassers, promised churches and community groups charitable contributions, and staged a last-ditch phone campaign that targeted 11 of Chicago's 50 aldermen to drum up support. Despite vocal and increasingly organized opposition, the May 26th City Council vote gives the retail giant a green light on at least one city project on Chicago's economically depressed West Side, where land is cheap and job prospects are dim. William McNary is the director of Citizen Action Illinois, which opposes the Walmart development.
Alderman, in a desperate attempt to try to create jobs in African-American communities, are looking at this as a possible job creator. What we see is Walmart destroys more jobs than it creates. It disrespects its workers, it abuses communities, and we cannot allow an employer that comes in unless they sign a community benefits agreement that raises the standard of living instead of lowering them.
The new Chicago School of Community Economic Development has estimated that Walmart's entry into Chicago would cost the region jobs, while the manufacturing sector increasingly struggles in countries around the world to meet the company's demand for cheap products. Walmart earned $9 billion in profits last year, while the average full-time Walmart employee earned just over $18,000, barely above the federal poverty line for a family of four. With at least one Walmart deal approved, critics say the company must sign a community benefits agreement that pledges to meet minimum standards in labor and business practices.
The middle class is fading, and people like Walmart is causing this to happen. We really appreciate jobs. We want jobs in our community, but we don't want them at the rate of being slave labor.
Mabel Huff of the Communication Workers of America says that while opposition has been gathering strength in recent months, Walmart has run an aggressive and well-funded public relations strategy designed to divide and rule. That approach has put historic allies on opposite sides of the table on this issue, along the fracture line of the desperate need for jobs, particularly in the African American community. Huff fears that with this first victory for Walmart in Chicago, even if groups are able to win a community benefits agreement from the company's critics will struggle to hold Walmart to their promises. The consequences are dire, says Huff, particularly for a number of thriving commercial corridors in Chicago's Latino and South Asian communities and for small businesses in Chicago's African American community.
You know, the devil is in the details. I've seen Walmart come in communities and turn them into wastelands.
Chicago's powerful mayor, Richard Daley, is a vocal supporter of Walmart's effort to build within the city limits. In Illinois, support from civic leaders has come with potent benefits. The world's largest retailer has won a minimum of over $1 billion in taxpayer bankrolled subsidies in the form of tax breaks, free or cheap land, cash grants, funds for job training and worker recruitment, and other incentives, according to the Washington, D.C.-based research group Good Jobs First. And among the 35 states offering Walmart some form of public subsidy, Illinois tops the list at nearly $150 million. Despite the setback in the city council, Chicago Alderman Rick Munoz says activists will step up their campaign against Walmart.
We got to continue organizing and working towards making sure that anybody that wants to come into the city of Chicago is paying a living wage, good benefits, and doesn't engage in predatory pricing schemes that kill commercial strips all over the city.
This is Chris Giovannis of Chicago Indie Media for Free Speech Radio News.
Citizens groups across the Arab world, from Morocco to Lebanon to Turkey, have condemned the Israeli attacks in Rafah over the past weeks. Inside Israel, Israel's own Justice Minister Tommy Lapid caused an uproar when he said that a photograph of a Palestinian woman sitting in the ruins of her house, which had been demolished by Israeli troops, reminded him of his grandmother. Tommy Lapid is a Holocaust survivor whose grandmother and father were killed by the Nazis during World War II. Iris Mackler travelled to Rafah in southern Gaza to find the elderly lady and hear her story.
For 3 days, Latifa Ibrahim Saleh has been scrabbling in the dirt. Her home in the Brazil section of Rafah was destroyed by Israeli troops on the third day of Operation Rainbow. Israel's week-long military raid on the Gaza Strip, which left more than 40 Palestinians dead. I want to explode, says Latifa. We worked for this house our whole lives. First my husband and then my sons. We put everything into this house, and now it's gone under the sand. It was the photo of Latifa sitting in the same spot crying that moved Israel's justice minister to think of his grandmother. She was turned out of her home in Europe in World War II and later murdered in the German death camp of Auschwitz. In the political storm that followed Minister Tommy Lapid's comments, he said he wasn't comparing Israel with the Nazis, but said that house demolitions must stop since, quote, there's no way to atone for the suffering caused to a helpless old woman. Latifa continues searching through the sand. The 66-year-old grandmother was forced to leave her home suddenly last week in order to escape the Israeli bulldozers. She didn't have time to take her most precious possessions. These included her family's gold, worth more than $20,000. She didn't expect that her house would be demolished. In fact, thinking her house was certain to be safe, her daughters brought her all their gold, too. If only the bulldozers had given me some warning, so I could take the gold before I left. But there was no time, says Latifa. And now my daughters and their husbands want their jewellery back, and I don't know that I'll ever find it. We explained to Latifa about the Israeli cabinet minister and his grandmother. She looks bemused, but her older son Mohammed is happy.
I say Alhamdulillah. I say thanks to my God, to this orphanage. We want more peace. We are have crazy man, and Israel have more crazy man.
Israel's military spokesman says that Israeli troops entered the Brazil section of Rafah for two reasons. First, because the main roads weren't safe for Israeli military vehicles, as militants had planted mines beneath them. A landmine had killed six Israeli soldiers in Gaza 2 weeks ago. Secondly, the IDF spokesman says Israeli troops destroyed homes while looking for arms smuggling tunnels. He says Israel found three tunnels during this operation, though none here in the Brazil area. Instead, the bulldozers demolished the children's zoo on this site, behind Latifa's house, and belonging to her son, Mohammed. He'd tried to alert the Israeli troops.
This is zoo.
However, Mohammed's entreaties made no difference. He was forced to take cover and to watch for 6 hours as the bulldozers destroyed his family home and his beloved animals and birds.
Because I love the bird all the time, I have chocolate and sweet to him. He haven't money to buy.
Mohammed has only two brightly coloured macaws left. Most of the other exotic birds and animals, including three kangaroos, have escaped or died. Standing by the carcass of the zoo's huge ostrich, Mohammed says he plans to rebuild in the same place.
This is my dream. This is my business. This is my life. I can't.
But for the authorities in Rafah, rebuilding is a mammoth task. Thousands have been left homeless, and vast areas are without water and electricity. This military operation and the huge bill for reconstruction come in the week Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon will outline his new plan for Israel to withdraw from Gaza. Iris Makler, Free Speech Radio News, Rafah.
FSRN will bring you a special Memorial Day documentary on Monday, Iraq, 1 year after the war, by correspondent Aaron Glantz. On Tuesday, we'll be back to our regular newscast when FSRN will kick off our cross-country summer coverage. For the month of June, Nell Abram will host FSRN out of Tampa, Florida. During July, Jackson Allers will be anchoring out of New York and Boston for the Democratic National Convention. And in the month of August, we travel to KPFK, where Aura Bogado will take the baton for a month of coverage from Los Angeles. I'll be back with the Republican Convention here in New York by the end of August. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.